Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, it's Monday night, and that means it's time for the Constitution Hour. I'll be your host, Ron Golden, and of course, the Constitution Hour is made possible by the Patriot Families. That's Patriot Families with a YS.com. If you're not a member, check it out. Get over to the website. I'd like to see a little more activity on the website. I've not seen a lot lately. But I think that really reflects what I'm seeing in society today. Everybody is kind of holding their breath. People are pissed, but a lot of them aren't sure what to be angry about. And of course, much of the blame gets directed at Congress or at Obama. While I agree that it's pretty apparent the leanings of Barack Obama and those that embrace his ideology, really I think the lion's share of the blame, if we're going to assign blame outside of we the people who've allowed this facade to continue, I think the lion's share of the blame should go to the corporate financiers who fund all this garbage. And I've told you guys, those that listen, the members of my audience, and many of the members at Patriot Families, if you've read some of my blogs over there, that it is, without a doubt, the monetary system that's allowing this insanity to continue. Now, in the past couple of episodes, we've talked about the Red Line Agreement, the Balfour Declaration, even had some conversation over who was financing the Bolshevik uprising, and the idea of relocating some of those undesirable characters of the 19th century, the Jews, the dreaded Jews, which gave rise to the idea of a Jewish homeland, a Jewish nation state. And of course, knowing that England was in control of the greater Middle East even prior to the war, the Balfour Declaration was a gift, I guess, for lack of a better term, to the Zionist organization and the Zionist-leaning Jewish communities it was a gift from Great Britain. And it was kind of a situation, depending on who you read, where everyone was very much in favor of the Jews having their own homeland, largely in part because that meant that they wouldn't be trying to assimilate into English culture or Spanish culture or French culture. It was like, yeah, let's give them a place to get. Yeah, you guys can have your old homeland right over there in the midst of all those crazy Arabs. That's absolutely, we're all for that. But let's not overlook the importance of the banking system during that time. If you look at the run-up to World War I, a couple of very important things occurred both in England and the United States. in the United States in 1914. We had the very first series of Federal Reserve notes being put out into circulation. And interestingly enough, in 1914 over in England, we had the first issuance of English notes in paper. Same year, 1914. I found that quite interesting. Since that time, we've seen the spread of centralized banking. If we look at the failed League of Nations that came about at the end of World War I, they were able to get a couple of pillars of the League of Nations installed, but ultimately it kind of collapsed and fell apart in the 20s. But what they did establish that did stick was an international world court and the creation of the International Bank of Settlements, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Now, all of these things sound very international, global, but the World Bank and the IMF occupy the same street in Washington, D.C., and they sit across the street from one another. World War I truly saw the shift in the balance of financial power from England to the United States through the Federal Reserve Act. The U.S. became the new creditor nation of the globe. And, you know, we think that globalization is some new catchphrase, some new idea. But quite truly, globalization has been around for a very long time. If we look back to the Bank of England from, oh, I don't know, the 1800s up to 1914, globalization was very much on the lips of the high financiers in the city of London. The Warburgs, the Schiffs, the Oppenheimers. There was a lot of mutual funding going on. And we know that, you know, Germany borrowed money from the Rothschild banking family in Germany. Same can be said of the French, the Rothschild banking establishment in France, and of course the English Rothschild Bank. That name comes up a lot when we study monetary history and we look at how this all got started and whether you believe that there is some grandiose conspiracy or whether it's all competing interests and it's all just chance and circumstance. It doesn't change the outcome. It doesn't change the current paradox that we're facing. But I think that there are too many of the same names jumping up, leaping out of the pages of history at us. And the important control over money, I think it's just not coincidence. I think the Rothschild family was brilliant. They understood the importance of money better than perhaps anyone had prior to them. Not that every government, every military, and every banker to that point did not understand the importance of money. Of course they did. What the Rothschilds did that the others were unable to do is they were able to create a network of banking that put them in the three largest empire states on the globe at the time, France, Germany, and England. Those were the big three. Once they had gained confidence in France, Germany, and England of the government and took control of the issuance of government currency, well, it was all pretty easy from there, wasn't it? I recently saw a video clip of some of the top bankers in the world meeting in Bern, Switzerland, discussing the current economic disaster that we're seeing globally. And one of the keynote speakers asked those in attendance to at least be honest enough to accept their role in creating the disaster that is currently centralized banking around the globe. But he was quick to point out that they had always found in governments a willing accomplice. And that's pretty simple, because government is the benefactor of this newly created money. It allows government expansion, and the larger the government becomes, the more power and control it has. It's really just that simple. Now, for some time, actually, since before the election of Barack Obama, there had been a push by our government, or at least by an agency that claims to be a department within one of our departments of our government, the Internal Revenue Service. But at least as early as 2006, there was a push to repatriate some U.S. money, some funds back into the government. What I mean by repatriate is steal. They wanted to steal money that some of these upstart, wealthy Americans had stashed in overseas bank accounts. How dare they take advantage of a system that had been in place for a very long time, decades even. Didn't they know? Evidently they hadn't read the rule book that if you're extremely wealthy in the United States, you start a foundation, a tax-exempt foundation, like the Ford Foundation or the Carnegie Endowment or one of a whole plethora of other foundations. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You see, this is how we hide money from the government. If you're one of the players. So the government set out trying to repatriate all this tax money that it had rightfully been cheated out of. See, it's not that this money belonged to the people who opened these Swiss accounts and bank accounts in Liechtenstein and bank accounts in the Caribbean. No, that money didn't belong to those people. It belonged rightfully to the government because, I mean, let's face it, had the government not given permission to the Fed to create that money, it would have never been created, right? That's kind of the storyline, but we know that's not wholly accurate either, because the Fed goes about creating billions, trillions even, that has nothing to do with our government. But you know, it wasn't long after that we started seeing stories pop up, and back in 2007 and then 2008, the IRS was putting a lot of pressure on, in particular, the Swiss banks. And I found that quite interesting. It kind of raised a few red flags for me. And then they got a hold of one former employee. And this former employee, named Birkenfeld, he worked for Credit Suisse, he worked for Barclays, and then he went to work for UBS. And it was during his time at UBS as a private banker that his responsibility, his job title, was to solicit wealthy Americans to open accounts in Geneva, Switzerland, through UBS, to hide their money. He said, oh, don't worry. We don't have to report any of that, and we'll never give you the forms. But it turns out that the U.S. government has agreements with these banking houses, many of which have operations in the United States, to actually give these depositors the paperwork, ask the appropriate questions, and procure for the United States government its fair share. I mean, that's all we're asking for, right? Our fair share. Well, see, back in 06, Congress had passed a new law which allowed the IRS to give rewards to, of all things, whistleblowers. The IRS was able to reward a whistleblower with anywhere from 15 to 30% of whatever tax revenue they recovered. Now imagine this young man's chagrin when he looks around and says, well, gee, golly, look at all this information I have. And if I turn this over to the IRS and they collect the tax money, I'll get 30%. That's a pretty nice chunk of change. So, this young man picked up his list, his depositor list, and contacted the Department of Justice. Well, now you can imagine the Department of Justice was probably all a tither to help this guy out, but that really wasn't the way it worked out for Mr. Birkenfeld. Even though he provided them with copious amounts of information, he found himself prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to prison right here in the United States for his role in helping these filthy Americans abscond with some of the Federal Reserve Bank's money, I mean the federal government's money. But the irony gets even better. He pled guilty in 2008 to a single count of conspiracy to defraud the U.S. And he was sentenced in August 2009 to 40 months in prison. While he was in prison, he got an award. And his award was $104 million. So, they at least ponied up, or did they? I don't know. But it would at least appear that the Internal Revenue Service held up their end of the bargain to pay this fine banker $104 million for being a rat, ratting out unsuspecting Americans that he first enticed to open these accounts in the first place. And then they put him in jail. And he should be getting out sometime soon, we think. But who knows? And of course, there were plenty of cries in the media, and I've always heard, you know, Sean Hannity talk about tax cheats. Isn't that awesome? Don't you just love being called a tax cheat when you don't give the government their pound of flesh? Pisses me off, I can assure you, and it ought to make you pretty angry as well. And now we come to our current debacle. Aside from our wars and rumors of wars and the fiasco that's unfolding over in Egypt now, on top of the fiasco that's unfolding in Syria, on top of the fiasco that's unfolding right here in the United States. But I told you guys that something was coming up in September. Right? And I still believe that September is going to be a hugely pivotal month in the history of the world for the foreseeable future. I still don't know exactly what's going to happen, and I suppose it depends on the reality or the truthfulness of some of the theories and dots that have been connected over time. Well, Hillary has a tremendous perception of the situation. I mean, we can go back and discuss Hillary and Bill's foundation and the funding of projects in Iran, right? And let's not forget that up until 2008, on the World Bank website, they had an interactive map that still showed all of the various projects that were being funded by the World Bank within Iran. And it's an interesting concept, this whole World Bank, Bank of International Settlements, and International Monetary Fund. It's an interesting setup in that the United States has veto power. The United States votes against something at the IMF or World Bank, and it cannot go forward. They must have our vote in order to move forward with any kind of project. So I would encourage everyone to go look at the World Bank website, go look at the IMF site, take a look at the projects they're funding around the globe, and recognize that for all intents and purposes, you voted in favor of every one of those. By proxy, it's a proxy vote. Ben Bernanke and whoever the acting Treasury Secretary is at the time, those are the two that have the vote on the boards of the IMF and the World Bank. And that's why they made such a big deal about, you know, Christine Lagarde taking over the reins after the Frenchman got hosed, literally and figuratively. Don't know what it was that he knew that they were afraid he was going to speak out on, but they caught him with the maid in his room, or so it would seem. That whole story, if you recall, was a pretty fast-moving and sordid tale. And when's the last time you heard of any high-ranking political figure from another country being booked and processed and housed at Rikers Island in New York? I mean, seriously. You really think that happens? Well, only if they wanted to. Only if they wanted to. So we have this thing coming up in September. And this thing that's coming up is another G20 meeting. And I wanted to share with my audience another little clip, just another one of those things that, you know, taken by itself, probably isn't that big of a deal. But taken along with everything else that's going on economically in the world, it's a huge deal, and it holds huge implications. I'm going to put you up a link here. Now, this is an article from March of this year. New BRICS bank to rival World Bank and IMF. So, this would have been the fifth meeting in a week. They had a busy week. The BRICS nations, and again, for those that aren't totally familiar, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And what they're talking about here is opening a bank for the former Soviet bloc countries and for China and for Brazil, right? They're talking about opening a bank just like the World Bank and IMF, with a few minor differences. One of those minor differences would be they won't be using U.S. dollars. Details, details, details. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this was back, as I said, in March of this year. I know that the economic outlook has improved dramatically since March of this year. I mean, my gosh, we had a stellar month in April. It was tax month, right? Tax day, April 15th. So we had a pretty good turnout for that. And since then, you know, the economic indicators have continued to improve here in the United States. My God, unemployment is down to, what, I think 7%, 7.5%, with a targeted goal of 6.5%. The U.S. dollar is going gangbusters. The stock market is huge. Real estate's on the recovery. It's on the mend. There was even a whisper from the Fed, and then someone slapped Bernanke's teeth out of his mouth. But there was a whisper at one moment of perhaps tapering the quantitative easing, the QE infinity. Well, I'm not sure about Yo. That may, she may be guest 3615 up there, Rod. Miss Linda had to go see the geologist, or something like that, a doctor. Anyway, so we have this meeting of the minds, and you have to know that Russia and China are the two biggest movers in this BRICS bank. And who can blame them? Honestly, who can blame them? See, we have the benefit or the... We have the benefit or the misfortune, I suppose, of being the home of the Federal Reserve Bank and the holders of the world reserve currency. It's what we operate on. It belongs to us. It's our debt. So we don't really see it like the rest of the world sees it. We're on the inside looking out, everybody else is on the outside looking in. And who can blame the rest of the world for sticking us under a magnifying glass, especially the last 4.5 years, given the idiotic lack of common sense coming out of Washington, D.C. Not that there was ever so much as a thimble full of it in the recent past, but it's worse now than it has ever been, if only because they're more emboldened, they're more brazen, they're more out in the open, they're actually more truthful, if we get right down to it. these idiots in Washington, D.C., and the fools that advise them, the Keynesian central economic planning jackasses of the world, who could blame China, Russia, India, Brazil, for wanting to get out from under this ignorant system that they're caught in? They have to diminish their currency. They've got to devalue their paper just to try and stay competitive in the export business. You got to understand that, you know, the countries that comprise this BRICS ideology, this BRICS cartel, if you will, they do account for about 40% of all the gross production on the planet. That's not a small matter. That's a pretty substantial portion of the world economy there, folks. And let's not forget that China surpassed the United States just recently as the largest economy in the world. So we have a lot of things that have aligned. The stars are getting into the perfect alignment, if you will, for this coming standoff, confrontation. But the gauntlet was thrown down quite some time ago. The BRICS nations actually petitioned the IMF and World Bank. I know, it's ironic. Remember, we just talked about the fact that the IMF and the World Bank cannot do squat unless the U.S. approves it, because we have a veto vote, we have a majority vote. So the BRICS nations had already approached the IMF and the World Bank about rethinking the reserve currency status of the dollar and coming up with a new currency, perhaps even partially gold-backed. That idea was floated way back in 2008. And we've heard other rumblings since then. And of course, since then, we've had the total collapse of the Eurozone. How the euro is still valued above the dollar is beyond me. But hey, I'm not a central banker. So now we have in March, ostensibly, no real movement from the World Bank and IMF towards addressing the concerns of the BRICS nations. So in March, they did their own thing. They got together, five of the heads of these countries got together, and they said, hey, let's start our own damn World Bank and IMF, just for us. You know, other people can join if they want to, and I'm sure they will find willing participants. And so that leads us into August, where we're at right now. And we know that our economy is doing so much better. And yet, just a few short weeks from now, these same BRIC nation heads will be attending a G20 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia. And you can rest assured that the topic du jour is going to be dumping this unseemly dollar-denominated reserve currency nonsense, because for all intents and purposes, as it stands right now, just about the whole damn globe is bankrupt, and in large part due to the unwieldy debt that has been brought about by this central economic banking ideology. if we remember back to, you know, Ronald Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Well, that wall came down. I remember the Times Magazine cover, you know, communism is dead. And I remember reading that and thinking, would somebody blow up China? Because communism isn't dead. Far from it. It's flourishing right here in our own good old U.S. of A. Of course, we call it a little something different. You know, we can call it democracy. We can call it socialism. Or we can really call it what the hell it truly is, which is fascism, which is exactly what's going on in China. It's fascism. Look at how the United States came to be a world superpower. I mean, honestly, look at our history, for God's sakes. I mean, in the 1860s, we were in deep trouble. We had a civil war brewing. And I would be willing to bet that at that time, the only thing that could have stopped that civil war, well, I don't think that would have stopped it even. You could have had some other country waltz right in here. Germany, Russia, England, hell, France probably could have whipped our tails in the 1800s because, after all, we were murdering each other at a phenomenal rate. But you look at how we became an economic and military superpower. One follows the other. Once we got the nationalization of our banking industry fully under our belt through Mr. Lincoln and the Civil War and the National Banking Act of 1863, the groundwork was there. The groundwork was there for this fascistic system to flourish. And there can be no doubt that it's modeled after the British system. My God, go back and look at the British mercantilism leading up to World War I. And the fact that, in all earnestness, in England, the merchants didn't want any part of a war in World War I. Because they were riding high on the trade from Germany, Spain, and many other places. But you know, there's money to be made in war also. And that's really what brought the U.S. to the rise of power, to the forefront. It truly was World War I. Right on the heels of our new Federal Reserve Act, we got World War I. We got involved. And as part of that involvement, we created the largest industrial machine for war the world had ever seen. You know, Mr. Baruch, who headed up the War Industry Board, was a great businessman. And we allocated everything. There were no disagreements. You were not allowed to go on strike. They weren't going to have any of that. Everybody got paid more than enough, great wages, and we created a huge war machine. Now, granted, we lost a lot of people. A lot of folks went overseas to die in Germany. And, you know, IG Farben, that was a conglomerate owned primarily by a merger with Standard Oil Company. Remember I told you that during World War II, Standard Oil was responsible for most of the petroleum in Germany. Now, granted, some of that was coming out of Mexico, but, you know, we would, Standard Oil would send tankers down to Mexico or down to the Gulf, down to South America, and then ship crude oil over to Germany. Germany had crude oil, but not crude oil that was worth a damn. You know, they were kind of in the same boat Venezuela's in now. Nobody could refine Germany's crude oil into proper petroleum product, proper gasoline, and certainly not for aircraft. I shudder to think what could have happened had old Adolf Hitler had good light sweet crude oil, like the Brent light sweet crude. You're absolutely correct, Doc. Germany made diesel from coal. They also used what was called a hydrogenation process that was developed, by the way, by Standard Oil and their chemists through IG Farben to make high-octane fuel out of coal by using a hydrogenation process. But make no doubt, make no mistake, that Standard Oil Company was instrumental in delivering fuel to the Germans. And in all honesty, if we had wanted to stop Germany in World War II, we could have just bombed their fuel supplies. And that would have been the end of it. One of the reasons Germany or Hitler decided to attack Russia was because Russia had some pretty damn big oil fields. Germany knew they needed more oil than they could get smuggled in through, you know, IG Farben, through Standard Oil. And so they wanted to take over the Russian oil fields. And Russia was supplying them, by the way, at this same time with about 4 million barrels of oil, but it wasn't enough. IG Farben is also the company that supplied the gas for the gas chambers. So go Amoco, Standard Oil, right on. I'm sorry that I'm off tonight, guys. I'm just not feeling it. You know, after a while you read enough and you see enough. Yes, Zyklon B, that is correct, Doc. Wow, smart fella, our Doc. He's pretty sharp tack. You know, just after you read so much of this stuff, it just gets to be not overwhelming. I get to the point of, who gives a damn? I start to question, does anybody really give a damn? I mean, certainly not anything we're going to be doing about it anytime soon. So, you know, I can sit here and spout about history, and to the extent that I know history. I don't know all of it, but I'm trying to read everything I can get my hands on. And you know, one of the problems you run into when you start researching something like monetary policy, man, I got to tell you, you know, if you start reading monetary policy from the Bank of England, the Bank of London from 1815 to 1914, well, you get a lot of different perspectives, but most of them are either from within the banking industry over in England, which is, of course, wholly pro whatever the policy they were doing at the time, or you get the opposing side, some German writer or some Italian writer or someone else who wants to take every opportunity to demonize the bankers in the English banking system. So it's hard to figure out, where do you find an accurate depiction of what really was going on? And I think, for me at least, the easiest way is to look for timelines that just look at specific big events, big occurrences that happened, and align those with other timeline events from around the world. And as you put those together, you start to see a picture unfold that, without all the minuscule backstory, which can be extremely interesting or extremely boring, depending on what it is exactly you're reading at the moment, but you start to see a picture develop. And for me, you have to ask yourself, as you see these pictures develop, you know, apply a little Occam's razor to the situation. What's the most logical explanation for this? what's the most logical explanation for the House of Rothschild? Is it the unauthorized biography that has Rothschild in Germany, who worked for a family friend, I believe it was, Oppenheimer? Anybody ever heard that name before, the Oppenheimers? So anyway, he goes to live with the Oppenheimers and grows up in the banking industry, learning the banking racket, starts his own gig, has three sons, funds them from government funds within the German Empire, as it were, and sends those sons off to a couple of three countries around the world. France, England, and I believe Vienna, Austria. Seems pretty plausible when you realize that there were these banking houses were set up. Now, did the man have a master plan way back when, before Waterloo? Probably not. Other than he knew that government banking business was the best banking business to be in. Because if you're in private banking, you are at the mercy of private individuals coming to see you to engage in your business. But if you have government business, well, the government has the ability to do something that you as a private banker don't have. They can tax the crap out of everybody and therefore bring you all of their money, whether they want to or not. And I think that the Rothschild dynasty grew out of that exact thing. So from there, it's not a leap when you start looking at the monetary history and how it developed very rapidly after the Battle of Waterloo in particular. Yeah. I don't know if his neighbor has a mute button, Doc. Just kidding. I know I'm probably boring you guys to tears tonight, and I apologize for that, but, you know, not a lot going on in the news today, unless you're following Jake Greenwald's gay lover being arrested in the airport over in Heathrow in London. I mean, I didn't even know Jake Greenwald was gay, but nor did I give a damn to know, quite honestly. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but go ahead, Rod, ask away, because I'm just rambling here. So go for it. Ask whatever you'd like. In fact, why don't you call in? 646-378-0321. 646-378-0321. Call in and ask your question instead of having to try and type it out on that godforsaken Chinese keyboard. Oh, that's easy to do. My train of thought is broken about every 30 seconds by my own brain. So you're not going to hijack me by any stretch. Oh, don't give me that too shy. You and I have had too many exchanges in the chat room for me to believe that you're too shy to call in. Unless you've got one of those little squeaky Mike Tyson voices, maybe that's it. Maybe he's afraid that we'll all giggle because he sounds like he's been huffing helium all day. I don't know. Might sound like Jake Greenwald's boyfriend or partner, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm thinking, Doc, I'm thinking that this was his Latin pool boy lover. But, you know, I try not to speculate into that crap because it turns my stomach, to be quite honest. I really don't give a damn what they do as long as they leave me out of it. Yep, that's true. Constitution certainly says that Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes. It does say that. And Congress has laid those taxes, and they do collect them. But that's, you know, about as far as it goes, because from there the money goes right to the Federal Reserve Bank. Just saying. Absolutely. But seriously, if you really think about it, now you think about this logistically. If you wanted to start a bank and you wanted to print your own money, you would want a way to make it attractive for people to want to use your money versus Bank of America's money or Wells Fargo's money. Well, we didn't much have that problem because the National Banking Act of 1863 pretty well took care of that. There was no more individual independent bank money. In other words, you know, Wells Fargo wasn't printing their own money versus Joe Blow's bank versus the Oklahoma State Bank and so on. Well, they actually delegate that authority to the Internal Revenue Service, apparently, even though I've yet to be able to find an act that actually created the Internal Revenue Service. You can find an act of Congress that created the Director of Internal Revenue and a collector, but nothing for the IRS themselves. That's a whole other story. So if you wanted to create this bank and print your own paper, you're going to have to do a couple of things. First, you're going to have to get a charter by the Congress because banking has all been nationalized. No, actually, they're under the Department of the Treasury, which is an executive branch affair, not Congress. Congress makes the rules, and then the secretary interprets them and creates what's called a Code of Federal Regulations that is, for all intents and purposes, the administrative bureaucrat's interpretation of the statute that Congress wrote and that the president signed into law. I believe I have my savior, Miss Linda Sills, here. Miss Linda, how are you?
Oh, God. Well, I had to go to the stupid doctor today, so not too good. That's an hour program right there, let me tell you.
I would go to the smart doctor because the stupid ones really aren't very good.
It's called Welcome to the World of Socialized Medicine and Oh Vomit Care. Oh,
yeah.
God.
I don't think Doc could have helped you because he's a foot doctor, as far as I understand. So.
Yeah, well.
Not trying to air out your dirty laundry on the show here, but.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little levity never hurt.
Sorry. I wish I could have heard your rant today, but I'll have to catch most of it in the archives. So.
Much other than me just blathering on, meandering through, you know, kind of glossing back over a lot of points that I've touched probably 100 times before.
Yeah, there was that one I think you sent on the BRICS Bank. And,
yep.
What was that?
Matter of fact,
there was a good old picture of Putin shaking hands with somebody I didn't recognize, but wow, that was scary.
The thing is, and you may not have realized, and I did that on purpose, and I did it. I sent that to both you and to Mike, and I wanted to see if anyone would notice the date on that.
Yeah,
March.
Because I remembered. that word BRICS before, but I didn't know how far back it went.
Well, I can tell you how far back BRICS goes, because they were talking about the BRICS nations all through this collapse and meltdown in the Eurozone.
Okay.
And as far back as at least 2010 is my earliest recollection, but it may have even gone back to 2008. They had petitioned the IMF, which I thought was just so cute, very naive. The BRICS countries had petitioned the IMF to look at a new basket of currencies instead of basing everything off of the U.S. dollar. Now, the IMF does use a basket of 8 currencies, but they're all weighted. They're all, every damn one of them is pooled together and then weighted against the U.S. dollar, and that's the standard. So, I mean, this is not something new, and I guess that was really the point that I was trying to get across. And, you know, we're coming up on this meeting in September with the G20.
Right.
And so this has been an ongoing thing where I think that all the stars are aligned just so that I believe that the BRICS nations, but primarily if you want to take all the other players out of that, and just put into the mix Russia, China, and Indonesia, okay, or Indo-Asia, if you will. If you just consider those three powerhouses, okay, I think they see, they're like sharks. They smell blood in the water. The U.S. is weak. We're weakened. Our military, my God, we've been at war continually since 1991.
Sure.
Right?
Well, yeah, if you don't count the other ones going back further, the other little skirmishes. But
exactly. They see that the U.S. is not in a position of great power, and this might be their opportunity to finally unseat the heavy hand of the Federal Reserve Act and the United Nations.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, which, I mean, if you read it, you go all the way back, and that's why I say go back to 1914, and that's part of what I was talking about earlier. You go back to 1914, the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, first series of bills gets printed and goes out in 1914. In 1914, the Bank of London begins printing and issuing the first ever English banknotes, right? At the same time, that's a bit of a coincidence for me, I'm sorry. And then we have this buildup going into World War One.
Oh, yeah,
the creation of the League of Nations.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. In the Jekyll Island book, I mean, you're talking about what I'm just now reading. I mean, right when the thinking of the Lusitania and how Churchill had his hand in it, and House, and I mean, all the way to J.P. Morgan, Cecil Rhodes, all these people. It's all coming together in this book. It's phenomenal. I mean, we got Trotsky in there, with this whole deal. Unbelievable. Exactly what you just were talking about, especially the right after the creation of the Jekyll Island, Creature from Jekyll Island.
Well, absolutely. All of that is going on. All of that turmoil is going on at that same time.
Right.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, and then we have this hugely important thing, you know, even in World War One, crude oil was not terribly important, okay? It just wasn't. But by God, I can assure you that the powers that be realized prior to World War II just how important it was to the drive of the industrial machine that was being created. And look at the industry that was created coming out of World War One and moving forward. Even though for most all intents and purposes, the United States actually fell back into a more of a protectionist ideology, I guess.
Yep.
Or isolationism, if you will. And there's a great book out about the protectionism that was going on. But you've got to hear what some of these people were talking about. And, you know, Rod was asking, why in the hell did Congress allow this to happen? And I said, it's because they're owned by the Federal Reserve. But it wasn't all of Congress, okay? And I would encourage anybody listening, go look up Charles Lindbergh. Anybody ever heard of that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Remember his son had a child that was kidnapped, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping?
Yep.
Go read what the hell was going on
during
in
that
Congress
time.
At the time of the Lindbergh kidnapping. I mean, you know, and Lindbergh was one of the most outspoken opponents of the Federal Reserve Act and the Federal Reserve and what was going on, along with another guy who, and they were both served on the House Banking Committee, and that other guy was a fellow named Lewis T. McFadden. And, you know, there's no way that this stuff happens without this banking system in place.
Right, right. Well, you've got so many factions. You've got the City of London, the Royals, the Rothschilds. There's, you know, our Federal Reserve System, the Bernankes of the world, and going back to the Greenspans and beyond. These are the power players, and they want dominance. They don't care, you know. And then as I'm reading and looking at the facts and the historical facts, it sure looks to me like everybody we thought was supposed to be these heroes were actually arch enemies. And they're just playing a big chess game. They don't care. They just want power. I'm talking about, you know, the Teddy Roosevelts, the Wilsons, the Lincolns, the Churchills, all of them. It's evil. They succumb to this.
Let me read you a quote from a guy who was mayor of New York City, John Halen. Quote, these international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful, corrupt
right.
cliques, which compose the invisible government.
Yep. Well, this has been going. This was 1917. They were taking control of the news outlets then. I mean, probably further back, but I mean, in earnest to get us into World War I.
Well, and you mentioned somebody earlier, Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt warned about this.
Right.
And as much as he disgusts me with his idiotic policy.
Right.
He warned that the real menace of our republic is this invisible government, which,
sure.
like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive yep. officers, our legislative bodies, our schools,
yep.
our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection.
It's crazy. So now what we're looking at, the craziness going on in Egypt and that entire region, and you know that there's the Straits of Hormuz and there's the Suez Canal. There's all this talk about if this collapses and Egypt does this and Israel does that. I mean, it's on fire. Our president's running from it. Putin's ready to, you know, come after him with a bullwhip, although knowing Barry, he'd probably like it. Stupid ass. You know what I mean? It's crazy. So I think that, you know, with the petrodollar and if they shut down these canals, man, can you imagine the price of oil?
Now, let me give you a hint here from Lewis McFadden again, a congressman from Pennsylvania, talking about World War I and the consequences. I think it can hardly be disputed that the statesmen and financiers of Europe are ready to take almost any means to reacquire rapidly the gold stock which Europe lost to America as the result of World War I.
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know. All I know is it's coming to a head, and it's coming soon. People who are in the know are preparing like crazy. I don't know if Bill's in the chat room, but he was telling me the other day, he says, man, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to bug out. He's like so afraid of this mess. I don't blame him.
Well, you know, there was a guy over in the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin.
Oh, Ilyich. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He had this to say. The state does not function as we desired. The car does not obey. A man is at the wheel and seems to lead it, but the car does not drive in the desired direction. It moves as another force wishes. And that other force he was talking about was the damn central banking.
Ah, wow.
The course of Russian history has indeed been greatly affected by the operations of international bankers. The Soviet government has been given United States Treasury funds by the Federal Reserve Board acting through the Chase Bank. England has drawn money from us through the Federal Reserve banks and relent it at high rates of interest to the Soviet government.
Yep.
The Nippon Story Dam was built with funds unlawfully taken from the United States Treasury by the corrupt and dishonest Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve banks. Again, one of my favorite Democrats, Louis McFadden, Democrat, Pennsylvania.
Wow. And you know, what I was also noticing during this funding of World War One is through the Federal Reserve System and through the central banking cabal, especially here in the U.S., every time they would print, borrow, and print and borrow some more, 50 cents on every dollar was stolen at that time in 1917 from the American people in that hidden tax called inflation. And that's not even counting what they were stealing out of their pockets for wages, you know, as income.
Oh, well, absolutely. But see, also, it's hidden in more ways than one, because you have to understand, in our run-up to World War One, our gross domestic product increased by 20%.
Wow.
You know why? Because we were building shit for the war. And all the industry had been pretty much taken over by government and geared up for the war effort.
Sure.
Same as it was in World War II. The difference was, in World War I, we didn't have a depression. We were coming out of a recession and a panic. But that panic, and this is the interesting thing to me, historically, when you look at the panic that we had just come out of in 1904, 1907.
Right.
That panic is what precipitated the creation of the Federal Reserve. And what they were what was going on in the public's mind, right, in the court of public opinion.
Yep.
Is you had this scene where people realized that the banks were lying to them. Okay? They had, for every ounce of gold they had in their vaults, they had loaned out 40 ounces of gold. And people caught wind of it, and they said, oh, bull crap. So they had a run on the banks. And people were going down to take their gold out of the bank's vaults. Well, the government was worried because this was creating a bank run, and several banks were on the brink of just going defunct. And that would have caused a huge problem. And in steps J.P. Morgan, and he says, hey, don't worry. I got enough gold. I can capitalize all the banks. So whatever gold the banks need, I'm here at the ready for my country to supply them with all the gold they need. And the people went, oh, wow. Well, everybody knew that Morgan was very wealthy, but they didn't know he was that wealthy.
Yeah.
So that started this discourse. That started this resentment.
Sure.
In the public, and they're going, well, who is this guy? Why does he have that much money? He shouldn't. Okay, so then we get the whole progressive Democrat ideology of the 99 percenters, you know, and he's the 1%. So they started talking about
breaking up the money trust. And the money trust was the Rockefellers. It was the Morgans. It was the Pierpont Morgan.
Right.
You know, and if they had enough money that they could bail out the government and the banking system, they had too much and we needed to do something about it. So that was the cry that started, you know, to break up the money trusts. And that's what precipitated the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. For one, they said we needed a more elastic currency.
Yeah, the whole irony of that is they couldn't bust that up. I mean,
no, because they're the ones that created it. And then, you know,
I know.
After they have their little meeting on Jekyll Island and hammer out all the particulars, and it's leaked to the news media, right, the press that they own, and then, you know, Morgan and the gang go, oh, that's a terrible idea, this Federal Reserve, that's just ridiculous. It'd just be a disaster for the banking industry. And, of course, the people said, my God, it's got to be amazingly good. A little reverse psychology.
Of course.
It worked fabulously.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean,
I think we've got Bill on the line, if I'm not mistaken.
Awesome.
Is that you, Bill? 812?
That's me.
That's what I thought.
I've been listening to you the whole time. I just couldn't get into the chat room there, so I guess I don't show up. But I've been listening to you the whole time, Rod. And, man, it is. It gets to be overwhelming. We've been doing this for so long, and you think more people would be awake to what's going on, or the more people would be aware of things, because so much has been exposed to the public in the last few years. By people like you and the many others, Linda, and the many others out there who keep spreading and doing the research and finding this stuff and bringing it out into the open. Yet it seems like we're screaming into the wind.
Well, you know, when you read it, when you, you know, and I'm going to post up in the chat room something that, you know, I had for a while and I've run across it again and I said, man. And it really simplifies it quite well. But honestly, if you go and research this stuff and pull the footnotes, you find out that there's reality in what's being said here. And, you know, it starts out the history of money. This is part three, and they're talking about the World War I, 1914, 1918. The Germans borrowed money from the Rothschilds in Germany. The British borrowed money from the Rothschilds in England, and the French from the French Rothschilds. And American superbanker J.P. Morgan was, among other things, also a sales agent for war materials. 6 months into the war, 6 months into World War I, J.P. Morgan was spending $10 million a day.
Good grief.
Buying materials.
That's
and
ridiculous.
Rockefellers was heading up Wilson's War Industries Board. Bernard Baruch made $200 million. And it goes on to say that Russia had spoiled the money changers' plans to split America in two, and remained the last major country not to have its own central bank. However, 3 years after the start of the war, the entire Russian royal family was killed and communism began.
Yep.
Now, is it any small wonder that the financing for the Bolshevik Revolution largely came from the Bank of England?
Yes, it did. Because they wanted the Tsar gone. They wanted to have
absolutely.
That central bank card. Yep.
Absolutely. And is it any different today when we look at the Middle East and wanting to expand the central banking system into the Middle East and get everybody on board? It's the same damned game.
I know.
The first thing that happened in Libya after Gaddafi ran 3 days?
Central bank.
3 days, and they had secured. Don't worry, folks. We sent in a team, and we have secured the central bank of Libya. Everything's fine.
And what does Syria not have?
Yep. Same thing Iran doesn't have.
Yep. Well, neither does North Korea.
You know, yeah, when you just look at it from an economic...
And recently, what was it? Iceland recently?
I think it was, Iceland did something.
Throughout the central bank, arrested the Rothschilds that were there.
Yep.
I'm not sure, there was a couple articles on that, so I'm not sure that all the details, but what's happening is quite interesting. It's kind of like watching a bad play.
It truly is, and again, let's take a case study of one that's much more recent, the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. They collapsed. Their economy collapsed.
Yep.
Right? So now we see all these stories where Russia is buying tons of gold.
Yep.
What are they using? What are they buying it with?
They're not buying it with rubles.
Weapons.
Well, I mean, what the hell are they buying it with? I mean, they're not trading oxen and cows. There you go, Doc. You got it. Oil. Absolutely.
So they're trading the oil for gold, and they're not using the petrodollar. I get it.
I think China
was doing that, too. Yeah, China was doing that, too.
You got it. Russia is one of the largest producers of crude oil on the planet.
Wow. And I know Putin. Well, in fact, the whole world hates Obama, so we're screwed, blued, and tattooed, guys.
You know,
You got to know Putin can't believe that Obama is a worthy adversary.
He said mail order brides. I know. You know, there are some pretty good-looking Russian women.
He's looking at Obama. He's looking at Obama like he's a Gumby or something. You know, he's just irrelevant.
The
man's lucky to get his shoes on the right feet.
But I think you're seeing in that statement, Bill, that largely that's how the United States is being seen these days, and rightfully so, irrelevant.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
Crap! Who's funding all these terrorist groups in the Middle East and stuff?
We are.
And I think you said the Saudis were handing them a hell of a lot more money to Egypt than we are.
Oh, sure, the Saudis are. But again, you know,
the Saudis are handing that money to the Egyptian military.
Is that who they're
right?
They're not funding the Brotherhood. Oh, okay.
No, they're not funding the Brotherhood.
The
like
Saudis,
Obama does.
Right. Right, and you know,
that's really the same with Kuwait and the embassies.
That's really a paradox that we see. And you go back in our history, go back to the late 70s, 78 onward, we have constantly heard complaints about crap that Saudi Arabia does and the U.S. government doesn't do anything about it. And we've constantly heard, why, you know, 17 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. What? Why are we
almost
after
every major attack
so
that's
on
been
so
on the United
right?
States, any kind of terror, almost any major terrorist attack on the United States anywhere has had Saudis involved.
Yeah, I wonder why. And why don't we do anything about it? Because we know what side our bread is buttered on. My God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, read the freaking history. Read the history of Iraq, Iran, the whole Red Line Agreement. Go back and read it. Doggone it. Read it. Understand it. Know who's playing
what. Wasn't Osama part of the Saudi family? Royal family?
Absolutely. Bin Laden's family was big into construction. I mean, if you had a construction project you wanted to build in the sands of Saudi Arabia, you had to go through the Bin Laden group or it wasn't happening.
So see, we have all these ties to that and this and that and all about this oil and stuff. Here we are. We have a chance. We have our own oil, but our government won't let us get it. We have as much oil as anybody, is my understandings. And
yes, we do.
And yet, we're blocked from getting that, but yet our government will let foreign companies come here and drill for oil in our waters and our areas.
That's correct, and it's evil.
This, it just,
well,
you know,
you,
it blows
you think
your
about
mind.
It, well, it doesn't blow my mind because they're going to have to pay leases, right? And they're going to get paid in U.S. dollars.
That's funny.
It's kind of like the old saying, you know, you don't foul your own nest, you don't crap in your own nest. Number one, why would we use all of our resources when we can buy everyone else's by printing a piece of paper? That's number one. Number
yep.
two, if we keep demand up outside of the U.S., okay, we are tapping into, by not using all of the resources in the United States, we are putting pressure on the broader market outside of the United States, the global marketplace. We are a major player in the consumption of oil. And it is oil that props up the U.S. dollar. And we're the ones printing the paper to buy it. Everybody else has to come to us to get that paper. And then they use that paper to buy oil. So it's absolutely instrumental that the petrodollar connection remain intact. And that is the threat that's posed by Libya, by Syria, by Iraq, by Iran, by Venezuela, by the BRICS nation.
Wow.
By India, for God's sakes.
Wow.
And that's why I think this play on gold, regardless of where you come down on, you know, if there's some grand conspiracy or whatever, it really doesn't matter. The fundamentals are there if you look at how this is playing out. You know, Bernanke trying to play off to Ron Paul when he asked him, well, if gold isn't money, then why do central banks hold it? Oh, tradition, really? So out of a sense of tradition, you know, China's central bank has purchased over 500 tons of gold in the last couple of years, right? I mean, that's a hell of a tradition, I got to tell you.
It's just craziness. You cannot go on the way it is. It's like a giant Ponzi scheme, and all Ponzi schemes end in the same method. They've collapsed.
Which is exactly why you're seeing all these sovereign countries buying gold. India, China, Russia, Venezuela. Gold is leaving the building at an exponential rate. And I found a really interesting article today. You know, I had talked the other day about J.P. Morgan is getting out of the commodities business, right?
Yep.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that J.P. Morgan, since it's decided to get out of the commodities business, it's selling one of its buildings. And that building is in New York City, and the real kicker is that it houses the largest vault in the world. It's 5 football fields in length. It's the largest gold vault in the world. And, by the way, it's empty, but, you know, that's just a side note. But the interesting thing is what's right across the street and connected to this vault chamber, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Well, ain't that amazing?
Now, you just got to wonder how much of that gold got shuffled back and forth in that freaking tunnel. Over the years, you know?
We've been let down by those that we were thinking we were picking to lead us. instead of trying to lead us, all they've done is try to control us, to take over us. And I watched a thing last night where a guy was talking about, well, they've had the ability to turn your phone on at any time and listen to you, or
yes,
to listen to you through your PCs without you even knowing it. They've had this ability for years.
Oh, yeah.
And you got to realize freedom is gone. When you have no privacy.
You had an illusion of freedom, sir.
Yep.
Well,
one that was crafted in your mind, but it never truly existed.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that, you know, when you're talking about the monetary system, and I mean, I can't even get people to understand the basic founding of the country, and that the Constitution, you know, was written one way, and then they screwed it up around the Civil War time. It's like I'm having conversations with brick walls. It's horrible. So this is what we're up against, Bill. I mean, that, to answer your question, you can't even get them to understand basic language, let alone monetary system and what's been done to us.
You look at what they're doing with language. They're forcing everybody. They're forcing this country to learn to speak Spanish.
Well, they can try.
Learning
a foreign
language should be an elective in school, and you should get to choose which foreign language you're going to learn.
Oh,
to force people
news.
To learn another language within your own borders.
I know, it's crazy. There was good news in the California front. Just a brief little tiny thing. Remember when Brown signed it a week ago where he said that they can have gender bender bathrooms and they can, you know, have, if they feel like a girl, they can go into the locker room? Well, the parents are,
if they
want
to feel
off,
up
so.
A girl, they can go into the locker room? Man, I need to move to California. Oh, sorry, that's not what you said. Never mind, I must have misunderstood you.
So the parents are pretty ticked off, so that, you know, we have a referendum state here, and now they're getting signatures. They're going to put this up to the voters and vote it out because it's their only recourse. Because all this was done without public knowledge, and, you know, they just pushed it through as soon as they got their supermajority of Democrat progressive libtards up in Sacramento the last election. So
now, Bill,
that's kind of where
I've only got 3 minutes left, and I wanted to get this in. Don't worry about the kids having to learn Spanish, because with the new Common Core curriculum, as long as they try, they'll never fail. You know, even if they don't learn
they
got to do is say, well, I really tried, and they get an A. So it's okay. You know, four times three equals 11. And if they can explain how they arrived at that, even though it's not the right answer, they'll still get an A. Hey, you know, what could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong?
I know.
We've got to think about their little self-esteem bubbles. It can't all just be about being right, okay?
And they wonder why they're not playing on the same level as other nations in education.
Well, this is what we mean, Bill, when
because
we talk about leveling the playing field. See, when we talk about leveling the playing field, I think there's this misconception that we want to try and equalize things and make it easier for those that aren't terribly intelligent to learn. But no, what they mean is like leveling the playing field, like you would level a city block. Okay?
They
annihilate it completely.
They
yes.
want clones,
yep.
Ron.
They
want little
idiots.
Clones. Everybody
they
exactly alike. Not realizing that will make this the most boring world there is, and that will end up backfiring on them because somebody's bound to go nuts having to deal with that.
They want a bunch of little thermal unit batteries like the Matrix. So just go plug your cable back in the back of your head, go back to sleep, and dream wonderful thoughts, and everything will be great. Guys,
thank you
for tuning in. I got
see
about
50
seconds left. God bless.
God bless.
Coming on with me, right, Bill?
I'll be on tomorrow, Linda.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye.
Sorry for a slow-moving, meandering, rambling, prattling show tonight, guys. But I'm just really getting burned out. And I got to get a new shtick, you know, because the monetary thing's just about worn out.
But we shall see. Maybe next month we'll have all kinds of new stuff to talk about. Thanks for tuning in, guys. God bless you. And until next Monday, be good. And maybe we'll see y'all here tomorrow night for the Patriot Families chat, and Wednesday night for Miss Linda's Right from the Left Coast, and Thursday night for Miss Terry Rowland with Patriot Education. God bless you. Take care. Bye-bye.